Welcome to Tania Lee Verhula. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
So, Tania, before we discuss the legitimacy and the concerns about the proposed gender recognition bill, would you mind describing in brief the story of Dr. Lydia Foy and indeed your own involvement in her campaign for justice?
Sure. Dr. Lydia Foy is a trans woman, and she transitioned back in the early 1990s and petitioned the Registrar General to change the gender marker on her birth cert so that she could be legally recognised as a woman. Because in Ireland, we have no mechanism to establish identity apart from the birth cert, really. And that's not what a birth cert is supposed to do. A birth cert is supposed to be a record of your birth, but we don't have an ID card system. So if you want to get your driver's license or your passport or anything like that, you keep having to default back to your birth cert. And so although it's not its intention, the birth cert has kind of become the document by which your legal identity is established, and that includes your gender. And although gender is all pervasive, it's only legally significant in a very few small areas. Certain crimes are gender-specific crimes. Obviously, gender is important in the context of marriage at the moment. But apart from that, there's not really an awful lot where your gender actually holds legal significance in a meaningful way.
Yourself are obviously a former board member of the Transgender Equality Network Ireland.
I am, yeah, and I'm a senior lecturer in the law faculty in Griffith College, and my research that I do and the work that I did with Tenny builds on my PhD studies, which looked at the legal situation for intersex people. So that's people who have been born with bodies that combine both male and female physical traits. And what I did was I looked at how the law defines gender and what the law understands a man or a woman to be, and how that legal understanding of what it means to be a man or a woman for the purposes of the law can basically deny the existence of intersex people or institutionally enshrine discrimination, I suppose, for intersex and trans people. And it was because of that work that I got involved with Tenny and I got interested in Dr. Foy's case, which was enormously useful for me in terms of understanding how the law determines gender in Ireland.
Legally putting it as far as gender, there is, of course, there's no mention in the Constitution. It doesn't define what a man or a woman is.
No. And until Dr. Foy's case, we had no legal test for gender in Ireland. And I suppose it's interesting to note that the whole idea of what's called a binary gender paradigm, which is just the notion that men and women are the only two possible genders, is something that's emerged relatively recently, legally speaking. If you go back as far as the 1600s, a very famous Chief Justice in England, a guy called Lord Cole, was writing about inheritance law, and he said that an heir can be either a male, female, or an hermaphrodite. So he was willing to recognise, and the law at that point was willing to recognise, a multiplicity of gender identities as grounding a legal identity. And that sort of disappeared very slowly. And, you know, the part of my work has traced that, and other people have traced the disappearance of alternative identities from the law. It all happened around the time, during Victorian England, around the time that the birth certificate and birth regulation legislation was introduced.
And in terms of the Irish legislation, the proposed gender recognition bill, I understand that its contents are based on the Yogi Carta principles.
Now that's debatable. I would certainly say that the starting point for the process of our legislation here was actually the UK's Act, and it's been a bit of a war of attrition since then to try and gently nudge the state to move towards a more rights-based approach to gender recognition, which is exactly what is encompassed in the Yogi Carta principles. And they're from 2009, and they do talk and speak to the fact that we all gain our legal identity or our identity because we are human people, not because we have any particular gender or identify in any particular gender. And so they're trying to foreground the inherent dignity of people. And I suppose some of that has come through in the most recent legislation, which is wonderful to see. And it's great that a process is being put in place. I mean, it's taken a long time for it to get here. As far back as 2007, the High Court issued a declaration of incompatibility between Irish domestic law and law of the European Convention on Human Rights, basically saying, look, lads, this state has to do something about this, because we're clearly breaching our legal obligations internationally if we don't. And it's taken a very long time for this legislation to come out. And it is great in some respects in that it does the existence of a mechanism to assert a legal gender identity different to that recorded on the birth cert is great, particularly when the birth cert is being viewed as a historical document that becomes fossilised the moment that it's been drafted, so you can't interfere with it. So from that respect, it's a good one. But it is, and it is a flawed piece of legislation in its current construct.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned the European Convention of Human Rights there. This is actually a question I asked of Michael Farrell yesterday of FLAC. Just how important is that as a tool to end injustice? Is that a good example of it being put to good use, that it is making these changes in our society?
Absolutely.
Slowly.
Slowly. I mean, the real power of the convention, I think, is in both in standard setting and in unpacking what rights mean. Mm. So it's not just about paying lip service, but it's about making the right meaningful on the ground. Former President of Ireland, Mary Robinson, and she was also former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, gave a speech over in Stanford back in the early to mid-2000s, I can't remember the exact year, and she talked about how we were at a transition moment in terms of human rights, moving away from the notion of setting standards and from the engineering of the thing and more towards the construction phase where we had to make it work in reality. And I think that's what the convention is doing, is helping states see how you give practical effect to these human rights, because it's all very well saying you've got the right to free speech, but that's a notionary thing. It's not until we understand what that means that it becomes a real thing for people living on the ground. And it's the same with the dignity rights, excuse me, in Article 8 of the Convention, which is the right that's engaged when we're talking about gender recognition.
Mm. I suppose, as the public will have seen in the media, there are a number of contentious issues regarding the scope of the proposed legislation, one such being that it forces transgender persons to divorce if they want recognition, basically.
I know, it's a truly bizarre, bizarre notion. If you think back 20 years ago, there were huge fights in this country about divorce, and so fraught was the notion of introducing divorce that we did a really bizarre thing, and we actually put the rules and regulations about divorce into our constitution, where in my opinion they have no business being, because that means you'd have to have a constitutional referendum to change the law on divorce. And I recall I was only a teenager at the time, but I recall, you know, Elizabeth Taylor being brought forward as the appalling vista where we might all go with 8 divorces, you know, if divorce were brought into Ireland. And amazingly, the country hasn't collapsed. But what's important was that we felt as a country it was so important that we not interfere with the notion of marriage, which is protected in the Constitution as having a special state, and in which the state has no business interfering. And it is truly paradoxical with that as our understanding of marriage and divorce, that divorce is something you can only get if you've been separated for 4 years, and you can only get it if your marriage has irretrievably broken down, and there's no chance of you getting back together whatsoever. And yet, here's a piece of legislation that would demand that couples who are happily married, who have come through a really difficult test in terms of their relationship, that they would be compelled to divorce. Whether they'd even get a divorce, of course, is completely arguable.
This
because
is true, yeah.
You know, how could you go to court and swear honestly that your marriage has broken up and it's irretrievably broken down when actually you're wanting to stay together? And whatever about the interference with the trans person's rights in that circumstance, it's incredibly invidious on the trans person's supportive spouse and any children that they have, to strip them of their rights to a constitutionally protected marriage.
I noticed a point you illustrated very well, stating that marriage is valid basically from the point of creation of that contract.
Yeah, well, when we look, like, I think it's possible to bring in a scheme, and I know Fergus Ryan from Maynooth University and myself have spoken about this a lot, that it is possible to bring in a scheme for gender recognition that doesn't tamper with marriage or require people to get divorced, because the law on marriage is that the requirements and the formalities for marriage must be present at the moment of marriage. And so if there's any question about whether or not a marriage ought to be annulled, the courts and the law always goes back to that marriage moment, as being definitive in terms of answering the questions. So one of the questions, or one of the things you have to have lined up to be legally able to marry, is that you must, of course, have the mental capacity, you must be of sound mind to get married. And just because one spouse subsequently develops Alzheimer's or dementia doesn't invalidate their marriage automatically because there's been a change in state there, because of course at the moment of marriage everybody was of sound mind. And similarly with these trans marriages, at the moment of marriage the couple presented as and were legally recognised as an opposite sex couple, therefore it was a legal marriage at the moment that it happened. And just like your marriage isn't invalid if one of you experiences mental difficulties later in life, neither, I would argue, is your marriage invalid because one of you changes your gender later in life.
One of the other major issues is that the bill doesn't cater adequately enough for children under the age of 16.
It doesn't cater at all or for at children all. Under the age of 16, and that's a big problem. I mean, the whole section, it's section 11 in the bill that talks about children, that whole section is problematic. I should say, at first, it is great that the drafters of the bill have dropped the age or have introduced a mechanism for people between the ages of 16 and 17. That's certainly a move in the right direction, but it's not perfect by any means. As I said, there's nothing there at all for people who are under 16, and so that means trans children, but also intersex children, where the conditions become apparent throughout childhood but might not have been obvious at the time the birth cert was filled in, can have problems. And this is not something that's a kind of an academic debate. It's a real thing. There was a case in 2009 before the High Court, S versus Ambordoxola, where a child who was born abroad and brought into Ireland on foot of a foreign adoption parents knew at the time of the adoption the child had an intersex condition, and the best medical advice in the country of the adoption of origin said, well, look, we think that this baby is more likely to be a girl, and so they put female down on the birth cert, and so female was on the adoption certificate, and female is what was noted in the register of foreign adoptions. But when they brought the child home to Ireland, and upon medical examination by our doctors here in Dublin, and also when the case was referred to the world experts in America, the conclusion was that it was a much more nuanced form of intersex condition, and that this particular child would probably more identify as male as he grew up. And so his family made a decision to raise him as a boy, not to do any medical interventions or anything, but just to give him a boy's name and to treat him as a son, and let him make his own mind up as he grew up about what he wanted. And of course then that causes problems in terms of going to school and everything. So they asked the adoption board, could they change the gender marker on the register of foreign adoption so that their son could go to a boys' school and so on and so forth. Because, you know, when you've got small towns, and we all know them all over Ireland, where there's been population explosions because of building booms, and there's pressure now on schools and places in schools. And, of course, a boys' school, they're looking for, and it's nothing about the particular boys' school, it's just any excuse to keep the numbers tight when you're really stuck for space. This person had a birth cert or an adoption certificate saying that they were a girl, but when they go to the girls' school, of course, they're presenting as a boy. And so that's a problem, just in terms of accessing education. And the other thing is that when a scheme is set up as the scheme currently is, it does facilitate a kind of, I suppose you can call it a sort of an almost institutional harassment or bullying of young trans people, because when the scheme says very clearly that it's only applicable to people who are 16 or over, that means that it gives an excuse for schools not to facilitate or to make things easier for the under 16s who might be wanting to transition or who might be questioning their gender. And it means that, I mean, and I do know, having spoken to Tenny, that there are cases of children where schools are saying, oh no, look, the legislation that the government are considering says you need two medical doctors to give you a saying, you need your parents to agree, and so we're not going to let you wear trousers to school, or we're not going to let you call yourself whatever you want or use the loo that's most appropriate for your preferred gender identity without you giving us all this medical documentation. And, you know, that then creates a circumstance where it's very difficult for a person to be themselves in school. And if the if the staff and if the school management aren't supporting someone at a vulnerable time in their life like that, well, then that creates a breeding ground for other people to engage in bullying activities, you know?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. Make just create a structure where, you know, bullying or isolation is just a byproduct
it
of
is.
The system
and,
itself.
You know, I was in with some of the people from Tenney and with a meeting with Minister Riley on Tuesday, and we were talking to him about this, and Tenney participated in a study a couple of years ago, and over 80% of trans people have attempted suicide at some point in their life. And if you think of the high rates of suicidality amongst young people and vulnerable young people, and we're taking a particularly vulnerable group here, that's really dangerous.
It is, yeah. While we're on the subject, another point that I believe you made as well recently, that over 16s can, without consent, legally undergo treatment for gender dysphoria.
I know, it's nuts, isn't it? Yeah, under Section 23 of the Non-Fatal Offences Act says anybody, once they're over the age of 16, can consent to their own medical treatment in whatever context. And so that includes making a decision to be treated for gender dysphoria, and then that the legislation wouldn't allow a person who can consent to whatever they want themselves at the age of 16 that would happen physically on their body, wouldn't allow them to get a piece of paper that would enable them to live their life in an easier way seems bats, I suppose.
It does seem a bit crazy. I suppose we should touch on the issue of medical certification as well. Basically what's happening here is it's placing an emphasis on certification by medical practitioners for recognition, basically.
Absolutely. And one of the things, and this is where when you asked me initially about the Jaugarte principles and was the bill written in light of those, I suppose this is where the big clanging note and the big discordant sound is happening, you know, because Thomas Hammarberg, the former commissioner for European Commissioner for Human Rights, and his successor, everyone has come out and said that there needs to be a decoupling between medical treatment pathways and access to legal rights, because your access to legal rights, particularly to the vindication of your human rights, are because you're a human person, not because you have any particular medical condition or whatever. Yeah. And The big criticism of the UK's Act from 2004 is that it sets up a diagnosis paradigm. In other words, you can't access the legal rights until you have a diagnosis of gender identity dysphoria. Now, thankfully, we've moved away from that, and there was talk in the general scheme that went before government in July that it would be a supporting statement from a medical practitioner, and the language in the bill, the wording of the bill that was published before Christmas, has changed slightly but significantly in that now it's certification. And when you're using words like certification or medical evaluation, that's the terminology of diagnosis. And so although when she made her statement to the Seanad a couple of weeks ago when this was introduced, the Taoiseach just spoke about this being, you know, a scheme that would mean you wouldn't need a diagnosis, you wouldn't need to have completed gender reassignment surgeries, but rather you just need this supporting statement. That's not exactly what the detail of the wording says. And so what it says is that you need a certificate from a medical practitioner saying that they are your primary treating medical physician, and the Act interprets that to mean an endocrinologist or a psychiatrist. So actually it's a very, very tiny pool of people who can even write this letter for you in the first place. There's only about 4 in the country, and the waiting lists are huge for them.
Wow.
And the second thing is that they have to confirm then that you have transitioned or are transitioning to your preferred gender, and that you fully understand the consequences of your decision to live permanently in your preferred gender. So they are certifying that you have transitioned or are transitioning, in other words, that you have some sort of a medical condition that has required you to do this, and that you have the mental capacity to make this kind of a decision. So they're also speaking to your mental capacity. And the three problems with that are that that then requires a form of medical medical diagnosis or medical intervention or some sort of a treatment pathway having been begun prior to you being able to access the rights. So if you're not being treated for something, you can't then access the rights. And also it means you have to have a primary medical treating physician, practitioner who's an endocrinologist or a psychiatrist. And not everybody will have, people who've been treated years and years ago might not have someone who does that job for them anymore.
Yeah.
So they might be excluded from access to the rights because of that. And essentially what you have here is diagnosis in disguise. Yeah, you know, it's a rose by any other name and all of that. It's the exact same thing.
I don't know, is it me or this? I wouldn't even call it a point. This is something I said to Michael Farrell yesterday. Like, even if you didn't have any understanding of the history behind this bill or the struggle of Dr. Lydia Foy, it a lot of it just seems really illogical. There's a lot of contradiction.
Yeah, but you know, there are. And it comes from... I don't know where it comes from directly. You'd have to speak to the people who wrote the bill and who were in the room when they were deciding what would go in. Yeah. But there certainly seems to me to be a concern about fraud, you know, and any of the law that I have looked at surrounding gender recognition, including court's decisions, with the exception of the Foy case here in Ireland, which is a very good decision from this particular perspective. But any of the other cases that I've looked at have all talked about a concern that, that somehow this would facilitate fraud. And I think given the ostracization and the discrimination and the abuse that trans people experience, I think it's very unlikely that someone will put themselves in that position in order to get a document to say they are of the other gender in order to engage in a fraud. And so when you ask people what do you mean by fraud and you try to unpack that or you read the judgments in great detail, and the concern does seem to be that if you allowed gender recognition to happen, that you would facilitate marriage equality as a kind of a corollary to that. Yeah. And that's very explicit in some of the dissenting judgments before the European Court of Human Rights, in particular in a case called B versus France, where some of the judges said, and this is a quote from the case and it kind of is mind-blowing in a way, they said that they wouldn't allow the applicant to be recognised in her preferred gender identity because to do that would, quote, risk half-feminised men running around duping heterosexual men into unsuspecting homosexual relationships and then where would we be, unquote. That's what the judges actually said. And so I think Professor Alex Sharp from Keele University is right when she says that really underpinning all of this, the unconscious subconscious of all of this and the regulations and the need to be certain and to require proof is a homophobia.
Yeah, I've heard that point made a lot in the media. Before we discuss the future and the bill, I'm curious, Tanya, we mentioned before that gender is not solely a biological construct. So from a purely legal perspective, how challenging is it to incorporate these kind of emotive elements when creating new legislation?
It's not challenging at all. It's not challenging at all. The first case that considered what gender ought to look like from a legal perspective was a case from the UK called Corbett versus Corbett, which created the test that underpins Irish law as it currently stands. And that's both a temporal and a biological test. So it says that your legal gender is determined by the congruence of your chromosomes, gonads and genitals at the moment of birth. And because that's determined as a point of law, it can't then be changed. 6 years later, the Superior Court of New Jersey, which is their Supreme Court, disagreed absolutely with that test and said that the question of legal gender is a question of fact, and so that it only becomes significant when the fact of your legal gender is legally significant, and that you make the decision based on that fact, and that if there is a disharmony between your physical sex and your psychological sense of self, if you've taken some steps to harmonise them, whatever they may be, well then the law should respect and should recognise your right to self-determination and should allow you to be legally recognised as being of that gender at the moment when that is legally significant. So there's no reason why you couldn't set up what's called the self-declaration model. That's what they have in Argentina. It's what they have in Malta, of all places. So you declare to the state, the same way that you can call yourself anything you like, you can change your name by deed poll. For goodness sake, we allowed Luke Flanagan to call himself Ming the Merciless for a long while. We now know him as Luke Ming Flanagan. You can call yourself whatever you want. Nobody cares. It's legally irrelevant the vast majority of the time. Similarly, the idea with the self-declaration model of gender recognition is that you go to somewhere like the High Court office, you fill in a form declaring what your gender is, and you are then respected as being the expert on your own identity and your own sense of who you are as a gendered person. And the law then, it's an administrative process. The law says, great, you filed that. We now have that on file. And from this moment forward, we will treat you as a man or yeah. as a woman, depending.
And I suppose, as we've seen, like you said, Argentina are one of the leaders in this area. And having spoken to Michael Farrell of FLAC yesterday, he was telling me about the seminar he held with a German Supreme Court judge last week. And obviously, we look at that example in Germany, like it can be done. They had an excellent process for getting the legislation in.
Yeah, nothing is impossible. And you know something, what the Maltese experience shows us, because with the Maltese bill, what happened was the relevant minister completely got on board with the human rights arguments, heard what the community was saying, heard what the international experts were saying, and said, you know something, absolutely, you need to have definitive treatment pathways for access to medical treatment, but that has nothing to do with accessing your legal rights. So let's make the legal process as simple as possible so that people can live an easy life. And it's harder to discriminate and to bully against someone when the law says that what they're doing is okay. And so it's very simple. And what you need is political will. And if you have the political will to do something, change happens. When politicians want something, heaven and earth can be moved to make it happen. And it's the politicians who control how legislation is made. And if our Dáil and our Seanad and if our government got behind a human rights respecting version of gender identity legislation, gender recognition legislation, then there is no reason why we could not have a self-declaratory model here.
I suppose with regards to the future and this legislation, if my listeners are to take anything away from this, it is to say that the government should be taking this opportunity to implement best practice really in this area.
Absolutely. We are given a golden opportunity here to see what everyone else has done in Europe. We're the last EU country not to have some sort of a mechanism to enable a person's gender to be recognised. And we could bring out the gold standard here. And then the likes of Sweden, who brought in gender recognition in the 1970s, who are now looking at their bill and reviewing their processes and thinking about amending it to bring it more up to date. Wouldn't it be amazing if for once someone like Sweden was looking to us to see how to do something as opposed to the other way around? We could become world leaders in this. Argentina is a world leader in this. Malta, teeny tiny country, is a world leader in this. We too could be a world leader on this area, as opposed to just, you know, falling into the kind of the middle of the road type response.
Yeah. I suppose just before you finish up, Tanya, if people want more information on this subject in general, where do you think the best place really is for them to go to find it?
Oh, the best place to go really is to speak to Tenny or to go and look at their website, because they can direct you to all sorts of other sources. So that's Tenny, TENI.ie.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Tanya Niebuhrhilla. That was very interesting indeed.